This episode is sponsored by Jonas Paul Eyewear. They make the most stylish eyewear for kids on planet Earth. And this is where it gets really good, I think. With every purchase, you can actually help restore and maintain the eyesight of kids and families across the world through their Buy Sight, Give Sight program. If you've got a little one, or frankly, if you're in need of some stylish, smaller sized frames for yourself, check out jonaspauleyewear.com. The link will be in our show notes. You're listening to Plucking Up, a podcast that shares uninhibited conversations with celebrated authors, entrepreneurs, artists, and leaders about their pluck ups. Our guests share their sometimes never before told mistakes, rejections, wrong turns, and the more difficult seasons of their lives and careers. But they also share with us how they moved on and up and through to keep creating and inspiring others to build lives of purpose, passion, and impact. I'm your lucky and plucky host, Liz Bohannon. Isn't it just the best when we immediately land our dream job, like right out of school, day one? And it pays super well, and we love doing it so much. In fact, it's so our dream job that it doesn't even feel like we're working. That's how much it's just so fun. Just follow me on Instagram, you guys. Take my e-course, and I'm going to teach you how to manifest your dream job day one. You're going to get paid so much money. It's going to be so awesome. Okay. JK. Y'all know me better than that, right? Come on. Here in the Plucking Up community, we are all about celebrating the long haul, the twists and the turns, the mistakes, everything that we know goes in to building lives of purpose and passion and impact. Spoiler alert, it usually doesn't happen on day one, okay? So in this week's episode, I'm just so excited because we talk about all of these pieces of our story that may seem really disconnected, and then these moments where we can stand back and realize and see how they brought us exactly to where we needed to be. Our guest on the show today is Carla Hall. She's best known for competing on the Bravo TV show Top Chef and Top Chef All Stars. I found out during this episode that Carla is absolutely a kindred spirit. And we just talked about her seriously plucky adventures and how they led to her one true love, which is really good food. In our conversation, oh my gosh, she was so great. She also shared what it is like to pluck up majorly after you've had major success. And we kind of talk about how, when, what other people think your life is and looks like does not really match up to the behind the scenes and the assumptions that we can make about these amazing, successful people and how usually there's a story behind that, right? So my gosh, I hope that Carla shows up on my doorstep and maybe someday I'll do the same on hers because she really, really was delightful. And I think you are going to want to show up on her doorstep too after this episode. So I can't wait for you to listen in. Here we go. Carla, thank you so much for being with us here today on the Plucking Up podcast. We are so excited to have you and really excited to hear more about your story.
Well, thank you for having me, Liz. Nothing like a good old pluck up story.
Yeah, I love it. So tell us a little bit about, we'd love to go as far back in the Carla Hall story as possible. Tell us a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up? What was your childhood like? What were some of those kind of key foundational memories from your early days?
I grew up in Nashville, and I was born in 1964, so I am a late baby boomer. And okay. I think that says a lot about who I am, growing up in Middle Tennessee. And my single mom, she was a nurse. I was very close to both my grandmothers. I was close to my dad, too, but very close to my grandmother, and Sunday suppers at her house every Sunday. And going up after church, she lived about 30 miles outside of Nashville. And just to give you an idea about the food dynamic in our family, my grandmother was what I call the culinary matriarch. Okay. And my mother, up until my grandmother's leaving her house at 92, My mother was always going up there still to get leftovers or food that was cooked so that she would have food to take to work. Okay. I mean, come on. My mother's was well into her 50s, 60s, right? When this was.
Can I just say that I love your mom for that so much?
You know, when the people at her job would say, hey, Audrey, what'd you get? What'd you bring us? And so I think when my grandmother, I think she was, well, my grandmother lived by herself until she was 94. My great grandmother lived until she was 102. So,
oh my gosh, Carla, exactly, you got some genes.
That's what I'm saying. So for me, food is also a way to feed my body and so that I can be here and healthy up until 100 years old. I mean, that is already set up in my whole system. That's why I had to go like, so that's the stock I come from.
Yeah.
And I did not cook when I was a kid. I always loved to eat. I wanted to be an actress. So okay. I did theater from 12 to 17.
Wow.
I was very much an artsy kid. I loved to draw. I loved cartoons. I was just that artsy kid. I didn't get into food until I was... I guess in my early 20s, and that's when I quit my accounting job and went to France to model.
Okay, France. So can we camp out there really quick? So you graduated from school and you became an accountant for 2 years. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that experience.
So the accounting experience, gosh, there's some pluck up stories in there too. I worked at Price Waterhouse, and I liked my accounting teacher. That was the only reason I ended up majoring in accounting. Mm. That and because I didn't get into Boston University. I wanted to go to that conservatory. And when they kind of rejected me, I was like, okay, fine. I didn't want to do that anyway. I'm going to do accounting. I mean, as one would do, an about face. I worked there. I was working in Tampa, Florida. And I just remember one being the only Black person. So everybody knew my name. And I didn't know theirs. And
it was almost like a odd celebrity status thing where it was like,
yes,
everybody thought that they knew you or knew of you, but you were like, who are you?
Exactly.
Okay.
And I remember a partner coming up to me and said, oh, you must be Carla. And I said, and out of 250 white people, who are you? Because I thought I was kind of funny. I thought that was a great joke.
So you legitimately said that to him in the elevator. I love you.
And he had it out for me ever since then. So that was kind of a pluck up. Okay. You know, bad
get
joke,
to know
bad
the partner
timing.
Before you make the jokes in the elevator, I guess.
I know. And this was around, so this was in 86. So yeah, that didn't go over so well. And it was just a really hard job. I mean, everybody was, you know, it was all about attrition too when you work at accounting firms. It's really long hours. And, you know, I was an auditor, so I was working not only at the office and coming home and working and bringing that little disc. And I remember if you weren't working with the right disc, you wouldn't have the latest version of it. And I remember turning in something that wasn't the latest version. There were all sorts of things. And I was like, oh, my gosh, this is so stressful, you know, constantly second guessing myself. Mm. And there was one day when I was working in an audit and it was in Ocala, Florida. It was really, really hot, really humid. And I was tasked with doing an inventory of I-beam. So it's 100 degrees. I'm counting I-beam, a sample. And, you know, and so that sun is bouncing off that steel. And I looked over and I see one of the auditors from our client sitting there folding a piece of paper and trying to line up the edges, the corners of the paper. And I was like, oh, my God, that cannot be me. And 2 weeks later, I tendered my resignation. I was so afraid of becoming that person. That I said, I don't care. I don't need a job. That cannot be me. And I quit.
Wow. So it was kind of seeing a peek into a potential future that you were just like, I don't want this. It's so interesting because I think a lot of what we explore in this show is, you know, we talk to these people who are now in a place in their life. We're like, yes, I've found my passion. I'm doing this thing that, you know, brings me to life and it leaves everybody else to go. But how'd you do it? Was it a magic moment? Is there a formula? And it's so interesting because I find in so many of these stories that there's this common thread that sometimes finding out what you don't want is actually just as powerful as finding out what you do. Like crossing something off the list is actually a really, really important celebratory part of building a beautiful life of purpose and passion and impact. And so often I think we can feel like it's wasted or I made a mistake by doing this thing. But I think those moments where we stand in our truth and go, I went down this path, I tried it. I saw what, you know, the future could hold for me. And I am decidedly saying, thank you, no thank you. And mm-hmm. I'm moving in direction that those are actually really powerful moments in our story.
They are. And in that moment, I also remember my grandmother saying to me, it is your job to be happy, not to be rich.
Ooh,
go grandma. You know, and that was a good one. And I hold on to that. And so to your point, you know, it's like, what do you not want to do? And you only know what you don't want to do by doing it.
It's so
true. Not by going through a list of things, because there are all of these little things that about a job that you aren't going to find out about online.
Totally.
You aren't going to find out from another person because you're two different people. And so you don't have the same perspective.
Yep.
And so I'm all about, you know, trying it out. Okay. No, not that.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I think so often we think like, oh, I need to do all of this deep self-work, which I think is super important, but I need to go like, you know, lock myself in a cabin on the beach and have 3 days to like dream about my future. And while I think there's value in like creating space, I think oftentimes we think if I can just get quiet enough, the thing is going to come land on my shoulder and then it'll be like, I get it and I know what my future is and here's the magic eight ball moment. And so often it's just like, you just need to get in the ring. Like you just need to get in the ring and do the thing and then be like, how does that feel? Was it good? Was it bad? Was it what I thought it was going to be? And so it sounds like that's what you did. But tell us, okay, so you were like putting in my 2 weeks, hard pass. Don't want to keep doing this. How'd you get to Paris?
So I, in that 2 weeks, I said, okay, I had met these two girls who were modeling in Tampa. And just going back a little bit, I did the fashion shows at Howard University, which was a kind of a big deal at our school.
Okay.
So I did that. And when I went to Tampa, that was one of the things that I did when just to meet people. Somebody came up to me and said, do you model? I'm like, well, I have before in college.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a way to get to know people in Tampa. Okay. So when I decided to quit my job, I had met these girls and they were telling me that they were going to go to Paris. I'm like, oh, that's cool. All right. You know, maybe that's my next stop. And there happened to be a guy who was on a tour of duty at the accounting firm and he was from France, and I asked if his wife could just teach me a little bit of conversational French.
Yeah.
So in those last 2 weeks, I was learning a little bit of French. So
I love that. In your last 2 weeks, you're like, I'm here and I'm leaving and I'm going to get the most out of this that I possibly can and do some French tutoring on the side. That's amazing.
That's right. My transition was 10 words of French. So I said to my mom, Mom, you know, I'm gonna go to Paris. She said, well, do you know anybody? I'm like, no, I know these two girls, but you know, we're not really that close. She said, well, let me make some calls. So my mother makes a call and it was a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend, probably 10 times removed from my mom. I got a number from a girl from New Jersey, Rosalind Johnson, who was in Paris. And so, okay, I said, Mom, I have her number. I'm going to book a room and that's it. And I had a bag. I mean, I literally just went.
Oh my gosh.
And I had no idea about when to go, the seasons. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. I just went. I had nothing to lose.
I also love that, and maybe this isn't what happened, but it kind of sounded like you a little bit, how am I going to say this? Invited yourself. These two girls were like, we're going to Paris. And you're like, hey, that sounds fun. And just kind of like jumped on and took initiative. And I love that so much. I think that one of the phrases that I use in my own life is this concept of assume the friendship. Because I think, and this is just in a relational context, that it's like, I think so many of us spend so much time in insecurity, analyzing and like waiting to be invited to something or waiting for somebody to make it very clear that they want us to be there, or that they like us. And so often it's like, okay, well, they're not spending their life thinking about how to affirm me or make me feel welcome or invited, right? And so I opt out of all of these things because it's like, well, it hasn't been made abundantly clear. They didn't get the billboard with the neon lights that said, we want you here, you know? And I just find so often that if we can shift the framework from like, I'm going to wait until I'm invited into I'm going to be invited until I'm told very explicitly that I'm not, that it changes everything, right? That it's like, assume you have a seat at the table. Assume that you're invited onto the trip. Like, assume that that person wants to go get coffee with you. If they don't, they're adults and they can tell you no, and then you can take it and, you know. But if we can just like make that assumption and stop waiting for other people to make a move in our own life, I think it's what leads us to doing what, you know, a lot of people would say is a pretty gutsy, like, oh my gosh, you just like went to Paris and nobody really invited you and nobody like, you know, made the way for you. And this friend that was over there was like, you know, 10 times removed, but it's like, okay, that's good enough. I have a phone number and a couch and like, let's just go and see what happens. And it sounds like that's exactly what you did.
Liz, okay, first of all, I'm going to leave here saying assume the friendship.
Okay, yay!
The position is the friendship, and that's what I do. So if somebody said to me, oh, you should come over, I assume that you mean that. And yes. My cousin would say, they don't mean that. I'm like, well, why did they say it?
That's on them. If they're lying, right. I'm not responsible for the fact that they spout lies. They said they wanted me to come over.
Exactly. I will show up. I have shown up in Sweden. I've shown up in places around the world. I will show. If you tell me, oh, you should come over, I will come. So don't tell me that you want me to come over if you don't mean it. I will assume the invitation. I will assume the friendship. And it does. It gets you so many places. And I think that people have to be responsible. So if someone asks me something, I've gotten to the place where I'm like, yeah, no, I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to wonder. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, no.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
Don't want to do it. I don't want you to come either.
Yeah. I think that that is such a gift that we can give each other. It's just communicating directly. And as like adults who have agency, and Brené Brown, I think, is the one who says that clear is kind. And I love, love, love that phrase of like, so often we beat around the bush or we're not super direct because we don't want to hurt people's feelings. And in the moment, it can feel good to kind of fluff things up. But really what it does long term is it hurts people because you're confused and they're confused and you're all kind of walking around not totally knowing and just the directness. And it's like you can be kind and direct. And in fact, actually sometimes being direct is really the kind thing to do.
So it's agreed. Like, and I will tell my friends, I want my friends to tell me when I stink. I want you to tell me that. I don't want yes people around me. Yep. I don't want a yes team. I want you to tell me honestly when I stink. And and I will give you the same because my intention is always with love. And I lead with that. So I don't think that coming from that perspective, I don't think that somebody is trying to hurt me. Mm-hmm. Right?
Ooh, that's good. Yeah.
But when they are, when they do, then I am like, oh, whoa. Mm-hmm. I didn't see that coming. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And I think giving people in your life, I use the word authority, like that's how I say it to my friends. I'm like, you have authority to tell me when my ish stinks, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't give that to everybody. I only give that. There's probably only like 12 people in my life that I've said. Everybody else outside of that, I'm like, you can tell me, I might not listen. I haven't given you that authority. Like we don't necessarily have that trust. I don't necessarily believe that you know me and that you have my best intentions. But if you are in that place in my life where you are with me and we are in it together, it is like you speak the truth to me. And that is such a kindness to have people around you, even when it, like, of course, no one likes to hear that. Like, no one likes it when people tell them that. But to have people that love us enough that they can put a mirror up and say, like, hey, here's this thing that it seems like you're not getting, that ultimately, like, that's what beautiful, authentic friendship is actually made of.
100%.
Okay, so you invited yourself on a trip with two models to go to Paris. Yeah. You're like, hey, I'm coming. You showed up with a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend. And then what happened?
So I did have my pensione, and I remember, and I didn't call her right away. I went downstairs to this patisserie, and I'm trying to speak French, and I wasn't even eating ham at the time, but I could say hamon, so that meant I'm getting ham. So I went to this patisserie, and I said, un croissant du beurre, s'il vous plaît. So I said, let me try that. Un croissant du beurre. And I'm like, un croissant du beurre, s'il vous plaît. Un croissant du beurre. And I said, okay, how am I going to survive this? So the whole acting thing kicked in and I started imitating people. And I was like, un croissant du beurre. My mouth turned down and everything. She's like, oui, oui.
Bluffo, bluffo. I think actually that might be Italian. Whoops, I don't know. That is amazing. I love that you just like kind of used acting in a caricature to like give yourself the freedom to like exaggerate and kind of create some distance between like Carla and then this like French caricature in the bakery.
Yes.
So smart. So smart. I love that. I think sometimes, okay, this is probably really bad and I can't believe I'm putting this on the internet. Okay. I do the same thing. And sometimes like, I can get a little bit, because I run a company and I'm like wildly passionate about customer service and doing whatever you need to do to, you know, to make it right and to make an experience and to win the customer over. I will say that I have high expectations on customer service people. Mm-hmm. I also, you could say, have a little bit of a temper. Okay. Just a little bit of a temper. And sometimes when I am calling in, like, the last time I did this, it was with health insurance. And there are just some industries where you just know it's going to be bad. You are like, they are going to give me the runaround. I'm not going to get any straight answers. This is going to take 12 hours and a master's degree to get a simple answer, you know, about this thing on my statement, whatever. And so sometimes when I'm like, Liz, you need to get it together and you need to keep your cool, what I do is I put on a Southern accent and I just call in and I'm like, hi, my name's Liz Forkenbohan. And I'm calling about this charge because I find if I can just be another character and I talk in this accent, for whatever reason, it helps me, like, I don't blow my lid when I talk in that accent. And if I go in as myself, I know like 30 seconds I'm going to blow my lid. And there's like something psychologically about like acting, like putting something on and pretending, that just gives you like a little bit of distance between the thing you're trying to accomplish and your identity that can actually be really helpful.
Yes, because you are that character.
Yes.
So it's not personal.
Yeah.
And whenever you can take yourself out of the equation and have some distance, even if it's that accent, it's mind-blowing.
As the founder of a socially conscious company myself, I am always in search of brands that not only create amazing products, but also make a difference in people's lives. I could not be more thrilled to shout about Jonas Paul Eyewear truly from the rooftops. This company was started by Ben and Laura Harrison, who have become dear friends of Ben and I. When their son Jonas was very unexpectedly born nearly blind at birth, they realized firsthand how limited the options for well-designed, stylish, and affordable frames for kids are. And they started this company for Jonas and for other kids like him. And it gets even better. With every pair that you buy, you help save and protect the sight of kids around the world through their Buy Sight, Give Sight program. Today until September 6th, you can save 20% off any purchase. So head over to jonaspauleyewear.com so that you can order their try at home kit to get your kids involved, or your kids can virtually try on their glasses and find their perfect pair. The link will be in our show notes. Okay, so you start kind of figuring out your way around Paris, it sounds like.
I started figuring my way around. I met up with this woman, Roslyn, and through her, I met all of these other models. And I met a woman named Elaine Evans, and she was from Memphis, Tennessee. And she was there. She was much older than we were, and she was doing hair.
Okay.
So she would have these fantastic Sunday brunches with all the models. And it was wonderful because for me, it reminded me of the Sunday suppers at my grandmother's house.
That's sweet.
And it was that whole connection to food and family and just people that you knew. But at those brunches, all of these models who ate tons of food, by the way. I just want to put that out there.
There you go. I love that.
They could put down some food. They would be talking about, oh, my mother makes macaroni like this. Oh, my mother makes it like this. Oh, my mother makes it like this. And I realized in that moment, I had no idea. I had no idea how the food was made, any of the food, at those Sunday suppers. And I'm like, wow, how is it that I had been going there my whole life and I had no idea or no interest to find out? And it was at that point that I decided to go to the American bookstore and get cookbooks.
Wow.
And that was the turning point of when I started to be interested in cooking.
I love that. I found on this show that it's like, it seems like about 80-20. About 20% of people that come on the show are like, when I was a kid, it was obvious. Like, I loved this thing. I was really interested in this thing. And then I went on and I did this thing. And then the other 80% of us, I think, have a story really similar to yours. That it's like, you were in your mid-20s before you literally walked in the store to get a cookbook. Mm-hmm. Now, in hindsight, you can see all of these things. The Sunday dinners and how much you love to eat your grandma's food and, like, these pieces of your story that I think it would be very easy for you to, in hindsight, tell us a different story, right? Mm-hmm. That makes it all make sense. But what I love and what I think is so deeply encouraging to so many people is when that process of discovery is not necessarily linear. And it happens in a moment of time, a moment in time where you're just being present. Like you're in Paris and you're on this adventure and you're saying yes to like the invitation to go to the brunch. And then you're saying yes to sit at the table where this there's this conversation about macaroni and cheese. And something sparks this interest in you that you just could not have seen coming. But maybe because you weren't like desperately looking for it, there was like an openness to receiving it of like, oh, I'm like finding myself very intrigued by the macaroni conversation. I'm going to go to a bookstore.
100%. 100%. And I think that people, when you're not, you said a couple things. So one, being present. Also, for me, leaving my job was not about what I wanted to do. It really was about what I didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I was looking for clues, you know, right? I don't know. And I think that a lot of times people have an idea and they're so focused on that end game that they miss so many other things along the way.
Yep.
And I was picking up every little pebble, rock, stone, talking to people, right? You know, I have nothing to lose. All I know is I'm not working on the balance sheet.
Woo-hoo. Yes. I love that. I think the thought about being so laser focused, causing you to miss the clues, is really powerful because it's like, but I said I was going to do this since the time I was 16. And so I'm going to like keep forging ahead. Even when things come up that are like, well, that might've been a hint that you're going in the wrong direction. You have so much invested on like, no, I said I was going to do this thing and I've been on this track and I got the degree and I've invested X amount of money and my friends and family think that this is what I'm going to do. And so I'm just going to plow ahead. It makes me think of when I got engaged. My husband, I was on a girls' trip, and my husband surprised me by coming to the city that we were in. We were in Little Rock, Arkansas, and he left me a letter at this restaurant. So I show up to the restaurant, and the lady hands me a letter, and it's clearly from Ben, and it's clearly indicating that he's somewhere in the city and that he's, you know, that, I don't know, I have to go like find him or whatever. So I leave the restaurant and I know I'm like on this kind of scavenger hunt to find him, and I'm so laser focused on just finding him that I'm like walking down the street. Well, turns out he had put clues up all along the way.
Oh my God.
All along the way of this sidewalk, there were all of these clues. I did not see a single one of these clues. Not a single one. They were like hanging on lampposts. They were on the ground. They were like big and obvious, but I was just like, God, I guess I got to find, what am I looking for? I'm looking for Ben, right? But it just kind of reminds me of like my laser focus on what I think I was supposed to be looking for kept me from all of these things that were actually would have made the journey a lot easier to tell me exactly where he was and how to get to him. And I think that the opposite of that, right, is having just a spirit of curiosity and being like, I'm a detective and my job is to go out and find a clue today. Actually, not even to solve the mystery, just to find a clue and to be really open to what that might look like, which for you, it sounds like it was this conversation about macaroni and cheese of like, huh. That's interesting. No light bulb moment. No huge like, Carla, this is your future. You're going to be a famous chef on reality television. It was just like, oh, interested in the mac and cheese. And so now I'm going to go take the next small step, which is going to a bookstore and buying a cookbook.
Exactly. And then cooking became a way for me to just say thank you for couch surfing. Mm. You know, it was an act of gratitude. Mm-hmm. It still wasn't my thing.
Yeah.
It was just an act of gratitude. And I just kept doing it.
I love that.
Yeah. And by the way, I just want to say that I love Ben. I love a good scavenger hunt. And I want that to be my job.
Okay. Honestly, Carla, I'm not kidding. And now I know that if you give a mouse a cookie with Carla, she'll take you up on it. So we should probably talk about this afterwards because my next dream career actually does have something to do with really epic scavenger hunts. So maybe we should do it together.
You better shut your face. Okay, I don't want to talk about anything
else.
Did I just find my business partner? Oh my gosh. Okay. Now I have to be laser focused to not think about that. Okay.
That is my dream. Okay, we're going to schedule. I'm not kidding. We're going to schedule another call that's not for this podcast. And we're going to talk about our dreams. Okay, I feel so happy right now. Okay, so when did it transition from this thing you were curious about? It was an act of gratitude and service for people who had served you to the path that we all know you for.
All right. So I eventually come back home after 2 years. I was in Paris. Then I went to London and then I ended up coming back home. My mother got sick. She was fine. And I was in Nashville helping her. And I'm like, okay, I can't live here with you. So I ended up going to DC. And because that's where my sister lived. And my sister was pregnant. And I said, well, let me do a baby shower for you. By the way, I cook now. You know, everybody's like, wait, what? So I made all of these dishes. I made a quiche. I made a lemon blueberry bread, some biscuits with smoked turkey. Mm. I made a chicken salad with almonds and grapes. It was the Coronation chicken salad that I learned about in London. Mm. And so all of these things along my journey, and I'm turning them into a feast for this baby shower. That night, a friend who had allowed me to sleep on her couch in Paris was now back in DC and working. And she said, I'm sorry, I couldn't go to the baby shower. And I said, that's okay. I made some food. You know, I'll bring it to you tomorrow for lunch. She's like, oh, that'll be great because there's nothing to eat around here. And I said, well, if you don't have anything to eat, that means everybody around you doesn't have anything to eat. What a cool business that would be. And I left it at that. Mm-hmm. I get up the next morning and my brother-in-law had eaten all the leftovers. Oh, no. I mean, granted, I am staying there for free, but still, you know, okay, come on. So I remade everything because a promise is a promise and I'm a Taurus, loyal. I made a bunch of things and I was like, what am I going to put all this food in? And I put them into like sandwich bags and stuff just piled up in together. And I was like, oh, there's a picnic basket. So I grabbed a picnic basket. I put everything in there and off I went to my friend's, the doctor's office where she was a receptionist. So I walk in the door and Patrice says, oh, this is my friend Carla. She has a business. Inside, I'm like, what? She does?
Tell me more.
Right. But immediately, just like I did in France, the whole actor thing came out. And I was like, yes, I do. And hold the improvisation. Oh, so what's the name of your business? I looked down in a split second. I looked at that picnic basket and I said, the lunch basket. No. And I was doling out some sandwiches and everything. And at the end of this, they were like, well, when are you coming back? I said, I'll be back tomorrow.
Oh my
gosh. This is my new thing. So every day I went door to door at hair salons, doctor's offices, florist. I had 7 clients that I would see repeatedly in a week. In 2 weeks, I had 14. Oh, and gosh. I was the lunch lady for 5 years. I mean, I worked every single day.
Mm-hmm. That is incredible. And so you worked every day and you actually built that business up. That was like your full-time deal.
Yep.
Oh my
gosh. That was my full-time deal, finding employees. I mean, I found employees through an organization called Jobs for the Homeless. I'm like, you're homeless. You can come live with me. I mean, that was a whole thing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You were a social entrepreneur before we had the phrase social entrepreneur.
Yes.
I love that.
Yes.
So after you did that so it sounds like 5 years in, there was a shift.
5 years in, and then I went to culinary school. At 30, I decided to go to culinary school. I went to this French culinary school, and I had figured that I had the practical experience, but I just needed the theory.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how I looked at it. And I was a business major, I was thinking, you know, if I went to get my MBA, they would ask you to work first before you come to school, before you go to school into that program. And so this was very similar. So I had the practical experience of cooking and then going to school, I got that theory. And it was amazing because I could understand why certain things didn't work before and making those tweaks. And it was fantastic. Mm. I absolutely loved it.
I love that. What was it like to be in culinary school in your 30s? Were there a lot of other people in that life stage?
Yes. So I also looked for a school where there were career changers. I looked at several schools. I looked at schools where people were going in, you know, like at 18, 19, but also I looked for a very short program. Mm-hmm. I had already been working. I was used to making money. And so I had to look for a program that was fast. So I looked for a program that was a year in class and then a year working.
Okay. So tell us about, you went to culinary school. How'd you get on television? What did the foray into reality TV, how did that happen?
A friend called me and said, do you know about this show called Top Chef? And I started watching the show. And then she calls me a few months later. And I didn't start watching Top Chef until season 3.
Okay.
And I binged it. And then she said, oh, they're doing a casting call. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, I was catering at the time. And my sous chef says to me, oh, I had a dream you were on Top Chef. I'm like, oh, it's funny. I was just talking to Verlette about that. That night, I had a call from the production company to, you know, and they messed up the name of how they got to me.
Okay.
And so I was like, this is a crank call. And And it wasn't.
Wow.
And every single thing, I'm telling you, Liz, every single thing, big thing that has happened in my life, it was like the universe knew that I probably would miss it.
Oh,
and so
wow.
it was like a package. It was yeah. like, here it is. You here. You
yeah.
have to listen. You have to see this. It was like your clue, but it was like, bring it down, yeah. bring it yeah. down. Eye level. And so even how I met my husband, every big thing happened like that in my life.
So you went on the show, and then tell us yeah. a little bit about that ride.
So I went on the show, and it was crazy because I was 44. I was the oldest person in the cast.
Wow.
And it was hard because I was feeling a little insecure because there are all of these young and up and coming, well-known chefs, pedigreed, working for big restaurants or, you know, under big name chefs. And there I was, a caterer. Right. Yeah. And so I went through this period of, oh, I have to do what they're doing. So I would look to the right. I would look to the left.
Yep.
And I'm like, oh, that's what I'm supposed to be doing. Right.
Yep.
And it was a lot of that and not trusting my gut. So the first three episodes, it was not trusting my guts. And then all of a sudden, you know, I thought I was going to go home. And in that moment, I was standing there at the judge's table. And I remember thinking, oh, my heart felt like it was jumping out of my chest. And then I said, wait a minute. Nobody has ever died here. I remember having that
so
thought.
Good.
Nobody has ever died here. So this is an irrational fear.
Oh, my gosh. That's so good.
Right? And so I calmed down and I was averting my eyes. I didn't want to make eye contact with the judges prior to that thought. And then I was like, nobody's ever died here. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? I'm going to go home. Okay. I haven't seen my husband in 4 weeks. Okay. So this is not a bad thing. And so I started looking at them in their eyes and they were uncomfortable because I'm like, look, I'm like, you're a person just like I'm a person.
So good.
I didn't go home. And then when I started cooking again, I was free to be myself because I didn't have that fear.
Yeah.
And that's when I also realized fear prevents you from actually doing the thing that you actually do best.
Yeah.
Once I could step into my power and cook, that's when I started winning all of these challenges.
Wow, that is so good. I love that in the moment reframe of, because, you know, I've heard once, and I'm not a psychologist, but I've heard, you know, that we have these intense adrenal fear reactions because it's evolutionary, right? Like, because back in the day, if a lion started chasing us and, you know, whatever, we had to like kick it into gear for actual real survival.
Mm-hmm.
And now many of us, definitely not all of us worldwide, but many of us are no longer in a place where on a day-to-day basis, we're actually fighting for our survival, but our bodies actually are reacting like that. There isn't a difference from an adrenal perspective of how you feel, how your, you know, ancestor felt when they were getting chased by a lion to how you feel when you think you're gonna, this terrible thing is gonna happen, which is the terrible thing of getting rejected or, you know, losing your place or having to go home on the show. That, but our bodies, we can trick them into thinking like this is a life or death deal.
Yes.
And I think that in those moments where we can help our heads talk to our bodies a little bit and kind of say, but is it? And I often find this so often, I think people tell us like, ignore your fears. Don't think about them. Don't give them room. And I think that that actually contributes to making our fears more powerful. It's like, don't look at it. Because if you look at it, it might become real.
100%.
First, you guys can't see, but Carla's doing a little, she's got some hands going and we've got some head nodding happening here. And oh, there's a fist bump. She's going to narrate for the rest of the show. But I think that that gives it power. And if we can actually say, okay, you're afraid of that thing, lean into it.
Yes.
Actually imagine it. What would that actually look like? What would it actually feel like? What would the actual consequences of that be? So often, if we actually let ourselves look our fear right in the eye, it actually has the opposite effect of you end up in your case going like, okay, it would suck. It would be such a bummer. But then I would go home and I get to see my husband and I would have had this wild story about these three episodes of reality television that I was on. And it almost, it brings it like down to reality. And then you're like, and I'm equipped to handle that. Like that would not kill me.
Mm-hmm.
I could get through that. And then that released you. What I love about that is that, of course, the worst case scenario did not happen, but it puts you in a completely different place of
yes.
creativity and freedom where you were no longer operating out of fear of the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
But operating out of freedom to just be who you were and to do your thing and to stay curious and see what would happen with it.
And at that point, I'm actually at an advantage to all of the other people who are still there.
Yeah.
Right.
That's so good. So, okay. Tell us about, you've been on so many shows. You've like really made the rounds on the reality television cooking circuit. I don't know. Is there a show that you haven't been on? I don't know. But tell us about, so you ended up starting a restaurant and I know enough to know that it wasn't quite the easy peasy lemon squeezy. You did this thing and you had an idea and then everybody wanted to be a part of it and execution went perfectly. Bada bing, bada bang. So can you tell us a little bit about this season that was pretty challenging, or as we would lovingly refer to, maybe included some pluck ups?
Yes. I mean, and the thing is, when you are seen as a celebrity, the anticipation of actually opening a place is greater than probably anybody else. Mm-hmm. You know, people want to go. I felt that people judged and valued me based on what I could put out. And in this case, the widgets would be food at a restaurant.
Yeah.
And we had done Kickstarter and the whole build up from the whole thing of finding a space. We were doing the whole Kickstarter, letting people know what the process was. And because people don't know what the process is, after like 6 months, they're like, okay, open it up already. We're like, right. Oh no, but there's all of these other things that have to be done. That was the first pluck up.
Yeah.
To not bring people into the process because they don't have the patience for the process.
Yeah.
It's like, come in and watch this paint dry, right?
Yep.
Pluck up. 100%.
Yep. Oh, that's good. I have a friend who just did a Kickstarter recently and I'm like in the Facebook group and I follow all the things out of, you know, support for him. And seeing, it's hard. It is hard when you, because you're an entrepreneur and you are in it every day and you know 1,000,000,000,000 facts and constraints and financial and timeline and leases and permitting and blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
And then you have an audience of people who know nothing about any of that who are telling you how to do your job. Mm-hmm. And that is a hard, hard place to be in. And there's expectations and there's timeline differences and you're feeling this like pressure and you're like, oh, I'm feeling this pressure because I'm the one who invited them in. Like I invited them in. That was on me. I did that. And now
my bad.
Yeah, my bad. Goodbye. Goodbye now. We'll call you when the restaurant opens. That's tough.
Right. So we did all of that. And then we had a fantastic opening. I invited lots of people that I knew who were in the media and chefs, and they came and we were off gangbusters, got a great review in the New York Times and all of that. And then we had an electrical fire.
Oh my gosh.
We had an electrical fire about 3 or 4 months in, and we made the decision, and that took a month. We were dead off.
Oh my gosh.
Grounded for a month. And we didn't have the money to do PR like we had been doing.
Yeah.
And we made the decision not to do PR, that we could tell people that we were open.
Yeah.
And by not having a team behind us to reach out and let people know that we were reopened, 8 months later, people are you open? Yes, we've been open. And then at that point, it was too late because we never got the momentum back. And it was really hard. We started seeing people like attrition in employees. We just the outreach wasn't enough.
Yeah.
And our food was good. And the thing that people don't realize, having a successful restaurant has nothing to do with the food. It absolutely has nothing to do with the food. It's about managing the restaurant. It's all the boring stuff.
Yeah.
And, but let me tell you, I learned so much. And it was one of those things where so many nights I was so anxiety ridden, you know, in terms of paying bills and all of these things. And how much money do you keep putting in? Like, because at this point, we're borrowing money to put in, right?
Of course.
Because I believe in what we're building.
Yeah.
And, it just didn't work. And it's like, when do you call it?
Yeah.
And to have to be the person to call it. And then the people from the Kickstarter who donated $25.
They think those $25 bought them a whole big microphone to tell you what they think about that.
Okay. Okay. I mean, I had so many bosses out there. I had thousands of bosses. And what we had done in the restaurant, we had everybody's names in these beautiful frames. I mean, I would literally go by and look at the names. And I'm like, these are all of my bosses. And so that was really hard. And I was so grateful for that community, but also it was a love-hate relationship. But I learned so much. And people say to me, and then when it was over, people will say, I bet you won't do that again. Actually, no, I would do it the same way. Even if it would end the same way, I would do it the same way because I would.
And why? Why is that?
I think the experience was so good and it was so massive. The learning curve was so steep that, and to this very day, I say that whatever the reason was that I learned all of the things that I went through, I will use them.
Yeah.
The restaurant closed in 2017. And I am just realizing why I needed some of those things like this year.
Wow.
So the return, you know, talk about the long game. The return sometimes doesn't come immediately.
Yeah.
And you may not see and you may be really impatient, but I truly believe that there's no mistake in the universe. And I'm just now realizing that now. And let me tell you this too. I still have the lease. I could not get out of it.
What?
It was a stop work order long after I got out of the space, and I still have to pay rent.
What?
Girl.
4 years later, and you are still paying rent. Okay. Woo! So you have like a physical, tangible, monthly reminder when you cut that check of this pluck up. But yet, so I love that. You're just like still in it. Like your pluck up is just still kicking you in the stomach once a month being like, I'm taking your money. I'm taking your money again. Yes. Hey, it's March. I'm back and I'm taking your money. Mm-hmm. And yet your perspective is still, I'd do it again because the value of learning is so great. And it reminds me of your posture of like having the presence and the belief, if you believe deep in your heart that everything that you learned through an experience will eventually, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next month, maybe 3 or 4 years down the road, that it will come back to serve you, it completely changes your mindset and your mentality. And instead of looking for all of the ways in which your mistake is just still kicking you while you're down, it's like you actually start hunting for the clues and being on the lookout for like when that thing circles back around and you're like, oh, this is why I had to learn that.
Yeah.
And this is why I'm more equipped to do this thing today. And I wouldn't have got there if I wouldn't have plucked it up so mega 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. And I think it's really powerful to be in a place where you're saying it didn't all work out. Cause I think you can hear from people that are like, and I've interviewed people before that it's like their mistake was really an awesome thing that they accidentally did and then it all worked out, right? And it's like, that's fine. That's great. Sometimes that's what our mistakes are, but sometimes they're just not. And sometimes there's no way to spin it. And it's just like the thing that I set out to do, I couldn't do. And to hear from somebody who can so authentically and frankly call it what it is, but then say, and still, it served me. And still, I would choose to do it again, I think is really beautiful and powerful.
Yeah. And I think also, I'm a hustler. So, I mean, and I could, even though I didn't have a working relationship, I could absolutely understand all of these restaurateurs who were having to pay rent and do all this stuff during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Because I was doing the same thing.
Yeah.
2 years before they were.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah.
But also, I had to tell myself, okay, money is energy. And what kind of energy am I putting around it? And it also helped me hustle to get work. I mean, even though you see me on television, I'm still hustling to do other things so I can pay for this freaking restaurant that I don't, that can't even use.
This is so good. I love you. I love this episode because I think that oh my gosh, it's just so easy. It's so easy to see other people and there's one indicator for their life. So for you, she's on TV and she's the celebrity chef. And then it's like, okay, so now I know all other 20 facts about her life. You have no idea.
Exactly.
Like that the celebrity chef is hustling to pay a bill for a restaurant that she doesn't even run anymore. And like, that is it right there. If we could walk around in the universe as people who stop making assumptions about who people are and what their life looks like and the decisions that they have to make and the burdens that they're bearing and the things that are on their plate, we'd be in a different place.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine being somebody who is literally celebrity status. You must have felt like kind of Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, right? Like I'm going on the show, hair and makeup, famous on TV, I'm the ish. And then also cutting a check for this failed project and trying to hustle and figure out how I'm going to pay the bills.
Yep.
Ooh, that's good.
Yep.
So, wow, there is so much there. Can you share with us, like, when you were in the thick of it, those nights where you were like, I don't know if we can make this work, or how long do I keep it going? I'm curious, how did you answer that question in your journey?
So when things were really, really messed up and we were really struggling, the thing that kept me going, the thing that got me up, and there were long days. So I would get up at 6, I would do the chew, I would go to the restaurant, I'd be there until midnight, I'd go home, you know, and I would sleep for a few hours and get up and do it all over again, were the employees. Hmm. I wanted to have a restaurant so that I could have this community of employees, and they depended on it, right? Yeah. They didn't have another thing like I did.
Yeah.
And so it was really about the employees. And then we just got to the point where, you know, I had borrowed some money and we had gone through that money. And I was just like, as much as I want to stay, I'm not really helping anybody.
Hmm.
And then I have to say this too. My husband was being stressed out because I was taking money from the home and putting it into a business.
Yeah.
And when you're doing that, you're not helping anybody. It's like back to what we were saying, when you have a friend and you can't tell them the truth.
Yeah.
And you're just extending or delaying, you know, whatever fallout there's going to be. And then there's resentment. That's what I was creating by not facing up to my business truth.
Yeah.
And so we just had to call it. And it was really hard. And so I did that. And then after that, the chew ended. So and then there were all of these things, right? And then I kept saying to myself, you know, you're never given more than you can handle. How many times have I said that?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm still saying it. Okay.
Okay. But that always leaves me. I'm like, God, I know that you wouldn't give me more than I can handle. And then I'm like, why you got to believe in me so much? Can you have some lower expectations?
Can you lower your expectations?
I think you're a little wrong. Can you, lower your expectations a little bit and give me a little bit less? I'd be fine with that. Thank you very much. Can I just be like a C student here? Because C's get degrees. I'm fine. Oh, man. Oh, Carla, thank you so much. I honestly feel like I could talk to you for 6 more hours. I cannot believe an hour has passed. You are such a gift. Thank you for just sharing the genuine kind of behind the scenes. It really is. I feel so energized and so inspired. And your life is a course in hunting for miracles and in looking for the clues and staying curious and open and having a spirit of generosity and gratitude. So I'm so, so grateful. Selfishly, I feel if this never made the air, which trust me, it will, I would feel this was an amazing way for me to spend an hour of my life and time. And I'm going to call you about some ideas. So, and here's what I'm going to say. If you're ever in Portland, Oregon, call me. Here's your invitation. You told me that if somebody, and I mean it. So it's a great food city. I know you probably know that. So I'd love to spend some time with you in person. So if you show up on my doorstep, I'll know you're just being true to your word.
That's right. Oh, I'll be there. I'm like, hey, Liz.
I love it.
Thank you for having me. This was so good. And you know what? I have to tell you, I always feel like it's a great interview when I learn something about myself. And I only learn something about myself when the person is very present and I'm talking to them and whatever flows through. So thank you for this amazing chat.
Oh, thank you. It's so good. I feel the same way. So it's always good to know that it's reciprocated. Thank you for your presence and your generosity. You rock.
Thanks, Liz.
Oh my gosh. I hope you loved this episode and Carla as much as I did. This podcast was made possible in part by my amazing producers at Human Group Media. Y'all, if you want to make an impact and you want to seriously upgrade your wardrobe, will you check out SeikoDesigns.com? You can shop directly from the website, but you can also host a Seiko trunk show, which is super fun. It's easy peasy, and you can rack up Seiko credit that you can spend on our incredible new fall collection. So if you're in the mood for shopping that makes an impact, check out SeikoDesigns.com. Also, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Also, follow me on Spotify for my new album. This podcast was made possible in part by my amazing producers at Human Group Media. You can follow me on Instagram. I'm at Liz Bohannon. I love to hear from you about updates on the show. You can also follow at Sincerely Human or Human_Media on Twitter. All right, that's all. We'll catch y'all again in the next episode. And until then, stay plucky.